ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month, that's Downpour.com. On this episode, Santiago X and A Natural have found hip-hop success with their song Warrior playing on ESPN's Friday Night Fights. Writer, singer, dancer Christina Linehart's many adventures include a role in a circus that performed at Guantanamo Bay, and one of Time Magazine's best 100 English language novels, Never Let Me Go, and our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know.
Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. So does anybody watch NCIS?
Yes.
Yes. I like NCIS. I like CSI. I like all those procedurals. I loved Law and Order, of course, you know, and that pretty much spawned this genre.
Bong bong.
Yeah, exactly. So there's one of the cast members of NCIS, one of the alumni, we'll say, of NCIS, Cote DiPablo, is being cast in a new miniseries called The Dove Keepers. It's being produced by Roma Downey and Mark Burnett, you know, of Survivor fame. And it's all about, it's based on Alice Hoffman's historical novel of the same title, The Dove Keepers. And it's actually the story of what happened at Masada, which is, if you don't know, in about 70 CE, 900 Jews or so were forced out of Jerusalem by the Romans. They holed up at Masada, which is a fortress, and held off the Roman army for quite some time. So she's going to be playing Shira, which is one of the four women characters in it. And it's it's described as, her character is described as a sensual, mysterious, and fiercely independent single mother with uncanny insights and a quiet and mysterious power.
I like her already.
Yeah. Yeah. She's derided by some as the Witch of Moab, as she covertly practices forbidden ancient rites. Judaism has, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Kabbalah, which is kind of the mysticism of Judaism. And Islam has the same. All of the religions have more mystical, you know,
Aaron Kushner, she likes to write about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. So it's being well received thus far, so I'm kind of looking forward to it. I love histories.
Yeah, what an ambitious miniseries. I mean, I've heard of the story of Masada, you know, but it was like on the History Channel, you know, watching, you know, like a documentary kind of thing, to try to bring it to life, you know, with like these characters going, you know, and
make
their
it more
struggles, right? You know, it's just unreal. But you know, it is based off a book, so that helps.
No, by being based on a book that already has a following.
Right.
Yeah.
And more source material to work with, because, you know, with an event like this where, you know, when you're talking about 70, you know, CE, there's not a lot. It's not like now where we have, you know, hundreds of books on World War II. You know, you have usually just a couple of pieces of source material from that time. So I really enjoy the fact that they're going to explore not so much what happened. We already know what happened. 900 Jews held up in Masada, you know, fought off the Roman army. But the people behind it, what was going on? What was it like for the people inside Masada? You know, what were the characters involved? So yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
I mean, this could be a Native American story right here in Southern Oregon,
same
right?
Yeah, there you
Captain
go.
Captain Jack, down by the Oregon Caves. With the U.S. Cavalry knocking on a door.
Exactly. It could be one of those kind of things. Exactly.
And, you know, this is our 50th show.
Episode 50?
Yeah. 50. Can you believe that? 50 episodes?
That's crazy town. We're living in crazy town.
Wow.
And Charlie's turning, how old are you now? 100?
I'll be 110 in January. Yeah, that's right. And I was at Masada, so I'm glad you're finally going to do something about it. You know?
Movie. Did you still, do you have that $3 you owe Moses? Because he's been calling.
No.
Oh, yeah.
But I'll tell you, one of the best lines I've heard is a guy goes, dude, hey man, you know, what was Jesus really like?
Sure, that wasn't a burning bush.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen a I've never seen a burning bush, man. I tell you what, I've seen a few smoldering ones, but never had a burning one.
Well, I hope that you do some art when you're at home. Like, you whip out some beautiful creations, hopefully.
I have whipped out some pretty beautiful creations.
Because actually, there's some new research.
Actually, five of them.
They're all so sweet.
Yeah.
There's some new research from Germany that shows that the production of visual art actually improves different parts of the brain, the effective interaction between the brain.
Oh, man.
And
yay! They did this.
Look at us getting smarter.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I can feel my brain enlarging right now.
Don't get too egotistical.
No. Yeah. Finally, a reason to watch TV. Don't get me smarter. They always call it the idiot box. Man, I don't understand it.
Well, no, that's consuming art, not creating it.
Creating. Oh. Yeah, because that's exactly the study that they did on some newly retired individuals. It was almost 30 people from the ages of 62 to 70, so pretty concentrated. And what they looked at is the difference between, like, half of them were engaged in hands-on art, actually creating the art. The other half, they learned art appreciation. They did this course in art appreciation. They are comparing how does this affect the brain in terms of these two ways that it's working. And it turns out that those that were enrolled in the art appreciation course, they got tested twice, once before the class and then once after. It shows that they observed a really significant improvement in the folks who were creating art. And the ones who were doing the art appreciation, they actually fared worse at the end of the tests. Hmm. So interesting.
Well, there's a lot of variables in this study. I mean, like, who was teaching this class? You know, there's a lot of professors out there that'll just put you to sleep.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. There's so many variables.
but you know, I think the point of that, you know, is that, and it's so true, because we all from school on, you know, when you're making the little clay project or whatever, you're really
using, much more engaged.
Yeah, you're much more engaged, and you're I think you're smarter. You know, but if you're just looking at another student's, you know, clay creation and goes like, hey, look what I made. You're like, yeah, that's great. Okay. You know
what I'm saying? It uses different parts of the brain.
Right.
So, right.
Because when you think about it, like Picasso and Matisse, they were producing work until Picasso was 91, Matisse was 84.
Right.
They, when using that ongoing creativity.
And Renoir. The Impressionist? Renoir, the Impressionist, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, uh-huh. He worked, you know, even when he was so crippled with rheumatoid arthritis.
He was still creating.
He was still creating. He taught himself how to use his hands and you know.
Wow.
Because they turned into like claws and stuff, you know?
That's yeah.
So interesting.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the things, I saw this study actually, and I think it was like one of the main points, and this backs up research from other neuroscientists, is that those that were engaged in the creation of the art had like less decline in their mental faculties. Like it held off the age-related, you know, things that affect their brain. The deterioration,
because they were stimulated.
Right, like doing Sudoku or crossword puzzles or any of those things that engage your brain in that way.
Flexing those neurological muscles.
As opposed to appreciating somebody else. Like, you can appreciate art, but it doesn't stimulate in the same way that actually creating stimulates the brain. So
yeah, and you know, you can really see that, and when people that are creative, or and we've all known people that have come to us and said like, and they're so excited about something. They're like, yeah, you got to see this. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, I just made this or I just wrote this. And they're super excited about it. And you as an observer, you know, you might be, you know, like a little bit of like, yeah, I'm interested in it, you know, but you don't have the same level of enthusiasm.
Same level of involvement. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's totally different part of your mind. And like, you know, a lot of people think if you know facts or something, that's smart. To be creative, it's kind of like a different, you know, it's a smartness too or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a different part of your brain. It's like a different activity.
Right. It's like, Albert Einstein said that, you know, wisdom is practical knowledge.
I saw this really great quote from the legendary cellist Pablo Casals. And he was asked why he continued to practice the cello at age 90. And he replied, because I think I'm making progress.
Oh, wow.
Just keep getting better.
Just keep doing it. Just keep doing what you're doing. It's good. It's good for your brain.
Yeah.
Keep making stuff.
It's a fascinating story, Maya, because you know what? And now that I sit here and think about it, almost all the greats, right? You know, I mean, not all of them, but, you know.
Most of them,
they all lived to be, you know, such old men, you know, or old women.
And continued producing. Yeah. It's not like when they hit, you know, and that's funny because you think about it now, like in the modern era, you know, like you work till you're 65 or whatever, and then you retire. You know, these guys, they never retired. They just kept going.
Well, their dream kind of is, there's someone, some interesting quote. Someone said, every artist's dream is to drop dead while they're working.
Right.
And most of them do.
Hopefully not while doing a self-nude.
While doing a self-portrait.
In the nude.
Is that what I look like? Oh, my God. I have a heart attack.
That's funny, too, because remember last month, I think we talked about Matisse, you know, the reuniting of his four blue paintings, you know, or the, not paintings, but he did the what do you call it? You know, where he put the, exactly, that. And, you know, it's funny because we have talked about Matisse. We've talked about some of these artists and, I actually was talking to Cyrus once again because we talk about this stuff a lot.
All the time.
Yeah, we talk about it all the time. And we were talking literally about, you know, like, you see reproductions, but what do you do when you want to get one of the originals? Where do these guys go? And as we all know, Sotheby's is one of the best places to get, like, actual art. And you were telling me something that Sotheby's was going to be doing soon.
Well, yeah, you're right. Sotheby's is where you want to go if you want to get art. And, you know, the prevailing wisdom for all these years, you know, has been that the best time to buy art, you know, is when you can see it in person. You can go to a Sotheby's auction, you get to see it, you get to talk to people, you know, you're there in the bidding room and you make a bid. Well, of course, we've had the internet era for a while now. And just like everything else, Sotheby's is now going to the internet. They're teaming up with eBay.
All right.
Yeah. This is going to be, you know, a big move because the online business is picking up. You know, Christie's is already on the internet.
Not Christie's? Huge,
yeah, not Christie's. Yes. Christie's house. Yes.
But Christie's did it on their own. They created their own website, you know, I think trying to trade off of their name. This, I think, is really smart because eBay has...
Well, we talked about that on a show before about how they're bigger than Amazon.
Right.
They still are, eBay is still bigger than Amazon because we think of Amazon as such a huge giant because we're in the USA, right?
Right.
But you got to remember the rest of the world's like Amazon. Who's Amazon?
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to trust their money to them. But eBay's everywhere, and they were one of the originals of the information superhighway.
Yep.
As me and Al Gore like to say.
So by being on eBay, they're going to get another 145 million users.
Get out of town.
Wow.
Yeah. Really buying expensive art on the internet without sight unseen?
Yeah, but if you've got Sotheby's behind it.
People buy houses on eBay.
Yes.
Cars, houses, souls.
Well, just this last April, somebody bought $3.5 million over the internet, a record for an online purchase, and it was on Sotheby's.
They better have some good shipping and handling.
Insurance.
It was verified.
It was $1.3 million, but, you know, $800,000 that was for shipping.
You know, Sotheby's and Christie's, they are such, you know, historic.
Yeah, they're the Coke and Pepsi of the auction world.
Yeah, that you know, they get to ride on their name. If somebody else, yeah, Chrissy, like if you wanted to start your own auction house,
you sold Picasso's for $3 million.
The house of Chrissy.
Yeah, you know, it might be, you know, a little more difficult.
Yeah, just because you tell me that's a Picasso, I might not just take your word for it.
I know. That's Sotheby's, you know? Because, I mean, eBay, I guess it's all through Christie's. It's not like anybody
Sotheby's.
Can... Well, it's all got to go through them. How much would you spend? I mean, obviously, if we had all the money in the world, I just feel like, would you spend it online or would you actually go and buy it?
Think about this. Okay.
I'm so hesitant to buy like a big thing like that online.
Let's say you've got $5 million to buy a painting, which means you obviously have the money to go to New York and go to the Sotheby's auction. However, there's time involved in that. You know, I've watched a show, there's some auction house down in Atlanta and they get, you know, people on the internet, people on the phone, they do it all at the same time, you know, and it's like, you may have the money to buy, but maybe you got a meeting in Belize that day, you know, or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
Belize is a great place, man. I've been there several times.
Oh, really? Yeah. I know several people that have gone there and they love it.
You know what? I think more to the point is like, if you're going to spend, you know, $1.3 million on a painting, right?
Right.
You're right. Now, there may be the occasion, like it used to be, where you go into a museum, you see it, or you go to a show, and you know, or somebody's showing at a gallery, and you buy it. But if you have that kind of money, it's like, if I want that painting, I'm telling my assistant, I want that painting, go procure it.
Yeah.
Now, if he can get it on eBay, he's going to get it on eBay.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, you know what I mean? He's going to go, I got it.
I got it. I didn't have to go anywhere. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
The convenience.
Let your fingers do the walking, I think. You can save the yellow pages.
And you still can go to the auction. I mean, if you really want to go to New York, you want to see the painting,
it's still available.
You can do that. You can fly there, you know. And,
we can dance if we want to.
Yeah.
And, we can leave this world behind.
Exactly. And because it's online, I mean, you know, maybe there's more seats available for you. So, you know, you can get in there.
Yeah.
I'm going to save to dance, man.
Well, we all know online is where the future's at. I mean, we it's not the future. It's the now. It's the then. It's the coming up. It is everything.
19% increase in online sales on Christie's. Online bidders competed in 17% of all Sotheby's offerings in 2013. So, yeah, I mean, this is huge. Huge pickup in online business. And, you know, it just opens it up to so many more people. How many people can you fit in an auction room?
Right.
At Sotheby's, you know, I mean, let's just say 1,000. You know, it does not compare to 145 million people.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
There's a little phenomenon. Have you ever like been into a store where there's never anybody in there and you're like, and you know, like I know here in our town in Ashland, Oregon, it's just like, I've been into places like, and there is never anybody in there and everything that's priced there is like, you know, $2,000, $3,000. I'm like, what the hell? And it's like, but I never see anybody in there, right? There's always,
how do they stay in business?
They have the website.
They have the website. They sell their stuff online.
You're right. Yeah. And TV is definitely in that shift of being online.
We've talked about it. Hulu, Netflix, you know, Amazon Prime.
This commercial I saw recently, there's this antenna. They say they get to you all these channels, HD channels, all that stuff. All you got to do is buy their product.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you've seen all those as seen on TV commercials, right? I mean, you trust all of those things, right?
Well, you wouldn't advertise if it wasn't true, right?
I do.
No, I couldn't. It's illegal, isn't it?
That's where I got my whammo.
Dr. Bronstein's magic elixir or something? I don't know.
Yeah. There you go. Okay, wait, I'm confused. What commercial are we talking about?
Okay, there is a commercial for Clear TV. And we've talked about in the past how we're trying to get rid of cable any which way. I know, Jerry, you don't even have cable. You don't pay that bill.
Correct.
I still pay the bill. I'm the crazy one. But this new TV claim is they have an antenna. Basically what they're saying is that there's a law out there that broadcasters must actually put their broadcast over the airwaves. And this is something that you can just plug right into your TV and it'll magically pick up all of these shows and you can have it for free. It makes it sound great. I'm like, what am I, an idiot for paying for cable?
Well, we don't want to kind of take it that far, but
what am I, an idiot? Well, no. But the thing is, it's basically rabbit ears that you put on your television. You can you don't have to buy their particular product. You can stick rabbit ears on your TV, and whatever you get, and it's free. That's basically all the whole thing is.
There isn't a difference?
Well, no.
Yeah, because I thought the only channels that were like broadcast over the air were like ABC, CBS, NBC.
No, there's a myriad. Do you like that $50 word?
A myriad.
I love that.
Ooh. Yeah.
There are myriad channels being broadcast.
TV channels that you can pick up, and they're all free because they go over the broadband.
Okay.
Now, cable, you know, like with this Clear TV, what it does, it's a nice looking box. So if you don't want a rabbit ear sticking on your, you know, your out of your TV, you just, you know, you screw it in. What you do is you pick up the everything that's broadcast over the airwaves. So it's,
right,
you know, and it's phenomenal that they use the Clear TV. We can get it to you for free. Well, it's already free.
It's always been free.
It's already free. And they say that you can get hundreds of channels, but really it's only what's going to come into your airwaves. Do you know what I mean? Like it depends on where you live. If you live in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska, then you're not going to have as many channels.
Yeah, three
available
to five.
So you really need the cable to actually provide it for you.
So they're
but
pitching it like
in
you
the
can
New York metropolitan area, or, you know, maybe where you guys are. You know, you might have more of a chance to get some free stuff.
Oh, of course we would, because we're a thriving metropolis of 20,000
right,
people.
Right,
that's right.
Well, so how much does it cost?
Well, it's their little product is $19.95 plus shipping and handling.
Wow.
I mean, you could go to Radio Shack and pick up antennas. Probably the same price.
I did a little research on this after I saw the infomercial, and it is just basically rabbit ears is what it is, but hey, you know what? If you're on a budget and you want to watch this stuff and you don't have a computer and you can't download the apps and you can't access the internet to watch all this stuff online.
Right.
You just, you know, hey, so you spent, you know, $20 and bang, you've got the TV. Yeah.
This actually happened to me where I saw the commercial and I went down to Radio Shack and they sold me an antenna.
Huh.
You don't have cable now?
No, well, I haven't had cable in years. I just use digital cable.
This stuff that comes over the air, right? Yeah. Yeah, because I remember years ago, 5, 6, 7, whatever, when they made the switch from analog to digital and you had to get like a digital receiver and they gave them away free for like several years. And I think this is what that is that the stuff that was being broadcast analog is now being broadcast in digital and you have to have a digital receiver in order to pick it up. But that is, it's just the free channels that have always been there, your ABC, your NBC, your CBS, etc.
But you don't get like HGTV or
right, I'm not
HBO.
You don't get those.
You have to get those separately
thing,
on your computer, right?
Right. Or over the cable.
Is there a way of finding out in your area what channels you'd be able to pick up?
Well, like, I think like if you just you got one of these things, unplugged your TV. I mean, it's only going to, what do you have, a $20 investment? So you could just pick one up.
Wouldn't it be cool, though? Like,
plug
if
it
there
in
was
see
like...
what you get. If you don't like it, you could just plug your cable back in.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but
if they had like a listing of the different areas of what you'd get, that
like
seems
shows
like
it. Are. Yeah, but like
it's
Comedy
free,
Central,
Maya. They're not. Who's
going to
do that?
Okay, good point.
Well, you know what? Yeah. I'm sure you could get a list if you just Google it, as they say. Free TV, or if you just Google in the search bar, you know what transmissions are free are available in my area for free,
uh-huh.
And it'll come up with a huge list. There'll be all the stuff that's not just ABC, NBC, Fox, and all that other stuff. There's a lot, you know, like the C-SPAN and CNN and all that stuff is going to come up, and then you'd be able to watch.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was, when I looked at this story, I was laughing because I had never seen the commercial, because everything that I watch, I basically DVR, so I never watch commercials, so I hadn't actually seen it.
Yeah, well, in the commercial, he's on a yacht.
Watching TV. Yeah, I watched it online. Like, I'm out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and I'm watching free TV.
Exactly. Right. You got some girls in bikinis and it's
he's got a painting from Sotheby's.
Remember, I just always remember
that.
This.
Yeah, because you got free cable, all that money. Yeah.
If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Exactly.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The bottom line is it does work. You know, so if you want to get, you know, like it used to be back in the day where you turn a TV on, a TV was free.
Right.
You know, I remember when there was no cable TV.
Yeah, I do too.
There was no cable services at all. All TV was free.
Yep.
You know, so... yeah,
I would like that. I would be amazing. But then...
Yeah. But then you don't get the selection.
But then you know, that's when people had to, You had to watch the commercials.
Right.
And there was no DVR.
And as Jeff Foxworthy said, if the president was on, your night was ruined.
Yeah.
And
then, you know, you couldn't see, and with cable, you know, you get to see, you know, like you would at the movies, you know. Like,
yeah.
You know.
Well, and that's why I stick to movies. I rarely watch television. I like movies. I have a big movie collection. I watch a lot of movies. And on that, speaking of which, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but Quentin Tarantino is working on a new movie. There was a big controversy. It's called The Hateful Eight. There was a huge controversy because he wrote the script and then somebody, probably somebody at an agent's office or somewhere, leaked the script online. Right. And he got so mad, he said he wasn't going to make it. He was just going to throw it out.
We had to stir in the show, I think.
Yeah, I think we did talk about that. Yeah, exactly. So just to recap. Well, now Tarantino has changed his mind because it's just too good a script not to make. So he has Kurt
Russell. And also he has no other ideas right now.
apparently he's stumped. He can only do one at a time. So, you know, his last couple of movies, as you know, have been, he's been, I don't know, I don't want to say obsessed, but he's really been focused on these historical revenge fantasies. You know, it started with Inglourious Basterds, you know, which was a World War II, like killing Hitler and that whole thing. And then Django Unchained, you know, which was the slavery revenge fantasy. So this one apparently takes place a few years after the Civil War. But he's got Kurt Russell on board, which, you know, they've done several things together. Death Proof, you know, the Grindhouse flick. And Samuel L. Jackson is involved. And now Amber Tamblyn has reportedly signed on. So they did a reading recently on, I think, online. You could, like, actually see the actor sitting around the table reading it. The script is going to remain pretty close to what we've already heard. And they're going to start filming it in the beginning quarter of next year.
You know, that I'm glad you had that story because, you know, I didn't know anything about the script being leaked and hadn't heard anything about it because I have Clear TV, so I don't have access. I don't have access to all that crazy stuff. Yeah. You kids are watching these.
I think it was on a Reddit. They did an AMA on Reddit.
What's a Reddit, man? Oh, Jerry's site. Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes, it's my favorite site. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, I'm kind of looking forward to this. I like Quentin Tarantino. The thing I find interesting about this, and it kind of goes along with, we've already heard, those of us who've been paying attention already know the script because they did a reading. It's been, I can go online and get it and read it. And yet they're still going to make it and they're still going to release it. And like Kevin Smith has done this recently too. His new movie coming out this fall is called Tusk. And we pretty much already know the whole story because he's talked about it. The story came from a conversation he was having on one of his podcasts. And so I'm interested to see this trend of, we already know the movie's coming. We know who's in it. We can already read the entire thing. Are people still going to go and spend their money to see it?
Of course they are. Because you know what? We already know the outcome of World War II. We already know what happened. We'll still go see
Saving Private Ryan.
We're still going to go see Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
Formula.
You
know? Yeah. Formula.
Yeah, there's a big difference between reading a screenplay
and seeing it
acted out. You know what? You already know Shakespeare's play. You read it in school. But you go see the play. It's a whole different experience.
Yep, that's true.
So the short answer to that is yes, they will go see it.
Yeah.
Well, and plus, it's Quentin Tarantino, so it's almost mandatory. And, you know, just like Samuel Jackson being in the movie, he don't want to be in a movie, but, it, you know, it's the law, you know.
Yes, Tarantino's making a new film.
Yeah, he's got to do it.
Yep, exactly.
And another thing about this film is it's a Western. And, you know what, he has enough clout that he can put out a Western and people will actually go see it.
Yep, very true. Yeah, the movie takes place in Wyoming at a mountainside lodge where a winter storm traps a bunch of people.
Oh, don't give it away, man.
Sorry, I spoiled it. So it could potentially reach the theaters by the end of next year. If shooting goes as scheduled, you know, with the amount of time he needs to cut it and to market and everything, we could see it in the fall or winter of 2015.
So, we'll keep checking Reddit and find out what it's going to be.
Exactly. Like you were just saying, you know, it's like Quentin Tarantino is a brand.
Yes.
You know, and people want to see Quentin Tarantino films. Because Quentin Tarantino, you know,
that might be the
only
reason.
Yeah, the only reason why you watched the movie
is because Tarantino did it.
Right. Yeah. You know, and there have been directors like that before, like John Ford.
Yep. You know. Coppola, Scorsese, Spielberg, Lucas. It doesn't matter what it, you know.
Cyrus Emerson.
You know, Steven Spielberg releases a movie that's 90 minutes of his nephew playing with Legos. People will still go see it.
Oh, that was great, man.
That was the Lego, yeah. Exactly. Well, okay. So like I said, I'm a movie guy. I love movies. But when I do watch television, one of the shows that I really like to watch is Saturday Night Live. We've talked about it here. Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader. We talked about them recently. I've talked about my love of SNL in the past.
It sure produces laughter.
It does.
It does. I love that. And it's interesting to think back to the different people who've been on SNL who actually haven't lasted very long. Because and you, for some of these, that I, when I learned that they were on SNL originally, I was like, oh, I did not know that. Because they were just flashes in the pan. Such as Robert Downey Jr.
Yep.
And Sarah Silverman, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, yeah.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Damon Wayans, Joan Cusack.
Yeah, Damon Wayans, Joan Cusack. That's funny because Damon Wayans, Joan Cusack, and Robert Downey Jr. were all on for one season together, along with Anthony Michael Hall, who played the nerd in like Weird Science and The Breakfast Club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all did one season together. And then we're all fired.
And that's because that's so funny to think that they were fired when they're so talented and so funny.
They went on these great careers.
They went on to have these great careers. Here's another little tidbit about Saturday Night Live, right? And yes, I was there. The you know, one of the guys who's really famous for being on Saturday Night Live, and he started a lot of the things they still do to this day, like the news desk thing, is Chevy Chase.
Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
He was on. He was on the first season, and that was it.
Yep. Then he walked.
He said, "Now I'm out of here, man. I'm going to be a movie star."
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And he was. It's funny when you look at all of the careers that were created because of SNL. Then you could look at these careers that happened in spite of SNL. You know, mm-hmm. because that could have been, you know, being a one and done could be a death knell for some people. But I mean, Robert Downey Jr. last year was the highest paid actor in Hollywood. $75 million he made. You know, Joan Cusack's done pretty well for herself. Damon Wayans obviously has done pretty well for himself. Sarah Silverman also doing well. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Seinfeld, anyone?
The reason that she was on Seinfeld was she met Larry David when she was at Saturday Night Live.
You can make your connections.
Yeah, right. You meet people.
Yeah,
it's like all about meeting people, you know.
And there are other people that have had careers, even though they were on SNL, that didn't have anything to do with it. Billy Crystal was on SNL. Does Best in Show. Christopher Guest. Christopher Guest was a writer and a star on SNL for a very short period of time. But, you know, I think I talked about this a few months ago about that fateful 84-85 season. Mm-hmm. You know, where you had Downey and you had, Anthony Michael Hall and all of that. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a failed experiment of let's take these established movie actors and see how they do on a sketch comedy show.
For some of these, like Sarah Silverman, I didn't really know that she had started there. She was a writer and a player. And before she got the axe in 1993. And then she, of course, went on to start her own program, which I think is so funny.
You know, Sarah Silverman, you know, she was more of the writer on SNL than she was. She would perform in a few sketches, but she was primarily one of the writers, which is like, if you think about it, for all you women out there, you know, that's way ahead of its time. Have a woman to be, head writer.
Tina Fey was like that too. She wasn't really in any of the sketches.
She came after.
Yeah.
And she was in a
lot. But she was just mostly the writer. She was the head writer. But then she did the Weekend Update, and then everybody knew who she was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the one that surprised me the most out of that was Damon Wayans.
Damon Wayans.
I didn't know that he was
Damon
on there.
Wayans. Yep. Yeah. You know, I used to. Well, I guess when I was younger, I didn't watch Saturday Night Live like that.
You weren't allowed to stay up that late.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't allowed to stay up that late, but I did see they always had the reruns of the old casts, you know, with like Dan Aykroyd and, you know, Chevy Chase. You know,
John
they always.
Belushi.
Yeah, they always showed those. You know, so I knew about the show, and then. In Living Color came on Fox.
After he got fired from
SNL. But I had no idea it was on Saturday Night Live. I'd never seen him on there. I'd never heard him being announced. I just saw In Living Color, and I love the show.
Yeah.
You know, Jim Carrey and all
that. That's where Jim Carrey got his big start.
And that begs another question. Why haven't Damon Wayans or the Wayans brothers and Jim Carrey teamed up on any films ever since the show.
It makes you wonder if there's bad blood from their days on In Living Color. It's possible. You know, the funny thing, Damon Wayans is the only one from that group that got himself fired. You know, the rest of them, it was all like, well, this just isn't working. Lauren wanted to go in a different direction. The only person from that season that survived was John Lovitz. 84-85 was his rookie season, and he came up with that lie. He had that liar character. Yeah, that's the ticket. And that blew up. That was huge. That was and huge. Everybody else pretty much got fired, but Damon Wayans had a lot of conflict with writers, and he did a character that was a flamboyantly gay cop, and this is in 1985, and he did that same kind of character on In Living Color, but it just did not fly at SNL, and they told him not to do it. Like, he did it in rehearsal, and he's okay, I won't do it, and then when they got live on the air, he did it anyway. That's so he got it. He the axe. Yeah. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus, not only did she meet Larry David on there, she met her husband, Brad Hall, on SNL, too. That's they were true. Married. Yeah, I don't know if they're still married, but they That's were married really for quite some time. Yeah,
I know.
Your career and your husband all came from that 1 year on the show. That worked out pretty good.
So you're
good.
Saying that Damian Wayne saying, homie, don't play that game?
Damian Wayne, I don't think he ever did homie on that, but he, yeah, on In Living Color, he sure did.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I do know what time it is. It's time to get the answers, everyone. And when I need to know, I go to Jerry Renfro. He knows. So listen up, higher education is coming our way. Now I love it. And God bless America.
Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows. Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows.
I'm Jerry Renfro, and I'm in the know. September is upon us, and you might not know this, but September is a month with a lot of important history. And that's not just because it's the month I was born in, but that certainly helps. September brings us the autumnal equinox, a day when the Earth and Sun are in perfect alignment, allowing for an even amount of daylight and dark night. The equinox has always held special significance for many pagan religions, and in many parts of the world, September is the time to begin harvesting crops. For a lot of people, September represents freedom or oppression, depending on your age. Why? Because children return to school. September is Hispanic History Month, and the first Monday of the month is Labor Day. In the U.S., a national holiday, set aside to celebrate the working folk by giving most of them a day off of work. But historically, September is a month that's memorable for conflict. September 1, 1939 was the beginning of World War II when Germany invaded Poland. That same day in 1969, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi successfully led a coup and took over the government of Libya, leading to 40 years of bloody conflict with the West. In 1983, Korean Airlines Flight 007 was shot down by Russian forces. September 2, 1666, saw the start of the Great London Fire, which burned over 13,000 homes and businesses. On September 6, 1901, President William McKinley was shot while in office. On September 14, 1847, U.S. forces occupied Mexico City. On September 14, 1940, the U.S. passed the Selective Service Act, the first peacetime draft, probably because with Germany's actions in Europe, the Congress suspected it wouldn't be peacetime for much longer. But it's not all bad. September gave us the births of Rocky Marciano, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Agatha Christie, and Walter Reed. September 3, 1783 marked the end of the Revolutionary War with the signing of the Treaty of Paris. September 2, 1945 was VJ Day, victory in Japan, ending World War II in the Pacific. September 12, 1953 witnessed the wedding of aspiring politician John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier. And September 22, 1863, Abraham Lincoln signed the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation to take effect in the following January, January 1, 1864. So remember, even in a month that saw the start of World War II, the downing of a commercial airliner, and the institution of the draft, we also got some really great writers, a humanitarian of the highest order, the end of several other conflicts, and one heck of a good podcaster. I'm Jerry Renfro, and now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
And all I am is a man. I want the world in my hands. I hate the beach, but I stand in California with my toes in the sand. Use the sleeves of my sweater, let's have an adventure. Head in the clouds, but my gravity centered. Touch my
Santiago X and The Natural deliver personal stories, making their music unique while continuing their professional careers as an architect and a corporate lawyer. They took a break to speak with the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we're talking to Santiago X and The Natural, biggest rising stars out there in the rap scene today. How you doing?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
Doing all right, man. Doing all right.
So for our listening audience out there, just to give them, you're on the ESPN Friday Night Fights, and the song that really it's funny because the title's really got a hold of me, and it really got a hold of me because we love that song.
You know I want you lately, you're everything I need, and now I can't let go because satisfaction's guaranteed. You know I want you lately.
So tell me, you know, where did you guys come up with that song? Did you guys write it, or is it something that somebody wrote for you?
Like that song in particular, that right there, I was watching the Rome Diaries, and I saw this scene where there's this rock band, you know, really analog kind of, you know, live little section of the film, and everyone's having a good time. And I was like, I was really inspired by that. I was like, how does that translate into hip-hop, you know?
Yeah, we I guess unilaterally write all of our own music. Lawrence, well, Santiago X, he produces the music. You know, sometimes I help out with that, but he's the main you know, instrumentalist, and we write the music, we record it, and we perform it. With that specific song, I think it came out of our dual desire to break the chains, if you will, from our normal existence as corporate attorney, which is me, and architect, which is Santiago X.
And, you know, the bottom line for us is we're independent artists first, so, you know, we stress our originality, especially in the hip-hop game, where a lot of, you know, there's a lot of sampling and a lot of unoriginality, a lot of trend following. You know, we basically kind of exist in our own musical shells, where Jeff as a rapper doesn't necessarily listen to mainstream rap or trendy hip hop. He kind of delves into the lyricism through his experiences and doesn't necessarily try to emulate. And for me, my background, you know, is from rock music, dance music, tribal music, Native American music, and stuff like that. So we kind of draw on different inspirations to try and deliver something that is still, you know, somewhat relevant, especially the subject matter for us. You know, it's personal. The stories we tell, the passion behind it all. So it's something a little different, but still kind of packaged in a nice, you know, listenable format, so that you can hear, you know, on the ESPN.
So, you know what, The Natural, you know, you guys are making, you know, this great music, but I got to think that, you know, it there was some sort of influence or some sort of, you know, happened in your childhood that, you know, shaped, you know, what you guys are today and the sound that you've gotten. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Give us a little insight.
Well, me, you know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago in a very, if you would call it, like a broken home. You know, parents divorced, drugs, you know, crime, and my grandmother pretty much raised me. The things that I saw, the decisions that some of my friends made it very clear to me that I should not make those decisions, you know,
right,
and the repercussions. And so you don't make those decisions, right? You go away to school because everybody tells you somehow, some way, school will lead you away from all of this. Somehow, it'll make it all better. And you do that at the same time growing up in those situations become a part of your identity. So while I was able to abscond from the consequences of being involved in the activity that took so many of my friends to the grave or took them to jail, I still had, you know, those experiences inside of me. So it shaped my music, the things that I talk about, the topics I like to address, you know, like the grittiness of some of my verses. And, you know, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. I mean, anybody you talk to that grew up on the south side of Chicago, everybody has a story to tell, you know. I mean, I lived in a lot of different places. I mean, that's the experience of most of my friends that grew up here. Never really lived in one place, never really attended one school from kindergarten on. And you see so much pain, man, so much stuff that's wrong with the city. It's so segregated. And, you know, a lot of my motivation stems from that. Yeah, so, yeah, that's pretty much, you know, where I get it, get my motivation from, like the upbringing and like my family, pretty much.
You can hear it coming through in your music. So, you know, Santiago, actually, you know, can you tell me about your native roots?
Yeah, so, you know, I identify as 100% quote-unquote Native American, but I'm a registered member of the Cossati tribe of Louisiana. Our reservation is in South Louisiana. And I'm also an indigenous member of the Chamorro tribe on the island of Guam, which is also a U.S. territory. And I'm pretty active in the Native community here in Chicago, and also nationally as part of, you know, Native American arts. I do, you know, shows in Santa Fe, and you might see some people wearing my T-shirts, you know, some designs I've done. And you might even see the X from our Santiago X the Natural, you know, merchandise. You might see that in my artwork. there's kind of a crossover a lot of the art I do that's Native inspired and into the music as well. But yeah, it's great. The indigenous hip hop community isn't too large, so I get to hang out with other you know, Native hip hop artists here in Chicago and across the nation. And you know, we collaborate here and then to do some shows. So we kind of cross over. Jeff being in the African American community and maybe the Native American community, we kind of, you know, we do our shows for different youth, you know, groups to help inspire them.
Because, you know, something else that I do along with Santiago is we go speak to kids. Because you don't see, this is what's prevalent, right? What's prevalent is people who grew up like me, but they made it out by playing basketball or playing football or some sport. And also, the people that grew up like me that made it out because they became, like, big into gangster rap and selling drugs and stuff like that. But you don't see the person that made it out, that looked at all of those things and said, okay, I actually have a more legitimate shot at making it if I just go to school and study. Right. I don't have to be born 7'1". I don't have to, you know, risk my life, you know, moving drugs. And so this is what you don't see. So I like to say when I talk to kids that, look, I have the same story as you. We were on welfare. You know, my dad was a heroin addict, and my mom was a crack addict. And my friends got shot and went to jail. I just made different decisions, man. You can make, you know.
Yeah, everybody has a choice.
Right.
So how did you guys come up with the ESPN Friday Night Fights?
Well, let me tell you about that.
Okay.
First, our very first introduction to ESPN came from this site called Reverb Nation.
Right.
I think it was either Reverb Nation or Sonic Bits. I think it was Reverb. And we submitted because there was a show on the air at the time called ESPN Unite. And they were looking for, you know, songs. So we submitted a song. We got selected from there. And I think Santiago knew someone who knew someone at ESPN, so we're kind of able to leverage, like, hey, you guys already put something on the air, you know, check out this other stuff we have. And they really liked the Got a Hold of Me song. So they put it on ESPN First Take, right?
Right.
So after it was on ESPN First Take, which is like one of their flagship shows, you know, and it had a, you know, good response, the ESPN reps said, you know what, we like your style, we like your professionalism, we're going to give you guys a vendor account. So now, you know, we pretty much send them music and they deposit money into our account if they decide to use the music, if it's in their budget. And this is the second year in a row they decided to use Warriors on ESPN Friday Night Fights. And it's just been working like that. So we licensed it through October this year, and we did it, you know, through October of last year as well. So pretty great, man. Now, ideally, we'd like to get one of our, you know, tracks on one of the, you know, major sports events.
But we can't wait for it to happen. You know, you have any a new album coming out, or are you working on some new material right now?
Yeah, we're working on a lot of songs simultaneously. And it's kind of like, you know, whatever is clicking right now, what feels good is what we're going to release. And we are shooting for a release this week. So we have a new song called Anthem. It's kind of another sports rock banger, but kind of not to let our core fan base down. We're going to go ahead and push this one up first and try to release that this week. But following that, we have, you know, pretty diverse, eclectic mix of tracks that we're going to compile into. I don't know if it's an EP or an album yet, but they're all in the finishing stages. And we just signed a publishing deal with North Star Media up in Michigan, and so they're excited about our music as well, pushing those to you know, other outlets outside of the sports realm.
We can't wait to hear Anthem, and for all of our listeners, be looking for that to drop probably sometime next week or the week after.
Yeah.
Would you guys have a video for that, or?
We intend to have a video for every song, so yeah, we'll definitely have something for that.
Okay, well, you know, Santiago X, we really look forward to it, and we're so glad that you and The Natural came onto the show today, and you'll have to come back on, man, and let us know how everything's going and when you're going to be, when you get to some tour dates down, so we can let all of our listeners out there know.
We definitely will, man.
Okay, we've been talking to Santiago X and The Natural, and we want to thank you so much and have just a great day out there today.
All right, you too. See ya.
Thanks for the call, man.
Hey, thank you.
To learn more about Santiago X and The Natural, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Reinhardt's life may seem like a fictional novel, but she's as real as it gets. Charlie Stanton had the pleasure of speaking with her in this interview.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we're talking to Christina Linhart, and she is currently in Southern California, and she's quite the singer, and your story is just, like, incredible. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm looking over, you know, you do a little bit of everything.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, I don't do windows, but other than that, I do everything.
Yeah, so you have two CDs out, Circus Sanctuary and Voodoo Princess. You want to tell us a little bit about them?
Well, Circus Sanctuary was a while ago, and I had left Europe and an engagement to one of the royals of Europe, and I really dove into the circus world. And so that's why, hence the name Circus Sanctuary, because the circus really was a sanctuary for me. So I was working as a clown to pay for the money to produce the album. And then also, a lot of it was influenced by when I traveled around the world and different sounds that I'd heard in Africa and different parts of the world.
The circus thing is really something everybody, it's almost, you know, it's very cliche. I'm going to run away to join the circus.
Right. very much. So I sort of ran away and joined the circus, but I didn't really go on tour with the circus. But so many of my friends are clowns, and they all did the Ringling Circuit. And then I have friends who are Cirque du Soleil acrobats. And then I did join one circus, and we went down to Guantanamo Bay, but that was just for a week. And just finished my documentary, Guantanamo Circus, which is about when I went with a circus to Guantanamo Bay. And the documentary's been finished, and now I've been moving it, going to different film festivals. It won an award. I'm going to Brown University to present it for their Guantanamo Symposium. So I've been moving the documentary.
Now, how did you like it? Was circus life different?
Circus life? You mean in general or in Gitmo?
In general.
In general. You know, I always felt like a circus person at heart. So I always felt at home in the circus, I think. Yeah. The first circus I saw was in Switzerland. It was the Kinderzirkus, the children's circus. And I remember really being influenced by that.
Now, did you grow up in Germany?
Well, we commuted. My father had work over in Germany, Switzerland, Austria. So every year we spent about 3 or 4 months in Germany, Switzerland, Austria. So I do have a lot of childhood memories over there, but I also did most of my schooling here in Los Angeles.
So your second CD is The Voodoo Princess.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, with Circus Sanctuary, I was working as a clown to fund that. And when I was making Voodoo Princess, I was working as a luau dancer, so doing a lot of Polynesian, Hawaiian, Maori-style dancing. And I had been in Jamaica, and that's, I think, where I got the spark to do the second album. And it was interesting because I was hearing a lot of similarities between Jamaican music and Renaissance music, which I know a lot of people would say, how? But I don't know, I think stuff came over with the pirates and the penny whistles. So I took a lot of Renaissance tunes and gave them a bit of a Caribbean flair. So I channeled a lot of the album when I was there in Jamaica, and then I went to Ireland and actually stayed with a Swiss writer who I just had lunch with today. Her name is Gabrielle Alliot, and she lives in Ireland. And so I stayed in her guest home in Ireland and practiced there and then made the album.
Wow. And do you have a favorite track on the album?
It's hard to say. I'd say the first or the second. Bedlam Boys I like a lot because it was an old Renaissance tune that I rewrote and dedicated to the veterans I work with, New Directions at the VA hospital. But then I also like Redwood Theater because that's the O Mio Divino Caro aria that we rearranged and made a little more Andrea Bocelli, Kenny G sounding.
Oh, well, let's hear a little bit of that right now. Yeah, that was beautiful. Now, hey, you know what? I had a question for you. On your Voodoo Princess CD,
mm-hmm.
You know, I love the artwork, you know, on the cover. But there's also a photograph of you with this giant snake.
Yes.
Now, how did that come about?
Yes, that was interesting. Well, that snake was named Eerie, and that's a Jamaican word, I think, for meaning everything's all right, but I could be wrong. And that came about. I'm part of a group called the Fool's Guild, and the Fool's Guild is kind of like the clown mafia. It came out of the Renaissance Fair, and I had been King of Fools, but a couple years later, a man named Jolly Roger was King of Fools, and he was having sort of a Lafayette voodoo-themed New Year's party, and he asked me if I would do a dance with a snake naked. And I said, sure, that sounds great, if you get me the snake. And so it was really fun because it was amazing to dance naked with that snake. Now, the snake was 45 pounds and about 10 to 12 feet long. So it was also about half my body weight, so it was pretty heavy. But it was an amazing sensation to have that snake sort of slithering around while doing a performance and dancing with it.
Wow. And what kind of snake was it?
An albino python.
Wow.
That's why it's that yellowish color.
Oh, man. And did he behave himself, or, you know, I mean, with the heart of control?
He was in good spirits because his owner had just fed him, which was a good thing, because they say if they haven't been fed in a while, they might mistake human flesh for something they want to eat. But he had just been fed. And the biggest concern was him getting off me and then just slithering away. So I had to keep him sort of balanced on my body, and we had two what you call safeties. You have that when you do fire dance. You have people on either side of the stage ready to, like, intervene if something's about to happen. So we had a couple people on either side of the stage ready to grab the snake if he took off. Or maybe Erie's a she. I don't even know. I didn't ask the owner.
So what are you working on currently?
Musically, I've still been working with a group called Angels of Venice, which was around long before I was with them as an instrumental group. They were with Wyndham Hill, founded by a harp player named Carol Tatum. And we're still continuing to do work. And then I might do an album with Brian Pezzone, who's a fabulous crossover pianist, and we might do something very basic, a classical album of just Schumann and Schubert art songs.
And where do you get all your inspiration?
Good question. I'm slightly crazy. I don't know. I think having been exposed to a lot of different art forms when I was a kid in Europe helped a lot. And then having a lot of friends who are artists, that helps too. And friends from different walks of life as artists and different types of artists. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, because you know, you're entire life is just, you know, it seems like a, you know, a story somebody wrote.
thank you. Yeah, actually, I have been writing short stories, different chapters of life, and I did write a young adult novel that has yet to be published, called The Jellyfish Mafia, and that was about when I was a crazy teenager. So yes, yeah, so I've started to write a little bit more too.
And were you a crazy teenager?
Yeah, I was pretty derelict. I mean, I was a straight-A student, but I was hanging out with all these gangs and on the streets, and I dressed like Nancy Spungen. When I was 13, I wore black fishnets to school every day.
Oh, my.
And did the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that was back in the day when the Rocky Horror Picture Show was less trendy and it was more a haven for runaway kids.
Oh, okay. And was that in the Los Angeles area?
Yeah, at the New Art, the Sins of the Flesh cast. I think they're still going strong. I did their reunion maybe 2 years ago. It was pretty interesting to see Rocky then from an adult perspective or adult eyes and see actually what a great work of art the Rocky Horror Picture Show is. It really is a good work of art.
You know, they still play it. I know that in Newport Beach, California, there's a old theater that's there, and it's been there for like since 1930.
Yeah.
And every year they show the Rocky Picture Show, and everybody dresses up and comes to the show, and it's incredible.
Yeah, there are theaters that are still showing it every Saturday night. For example, the New Art has been showing it 30 years now every Saturday night. And people will still come and dress up and do what they call the shadow cast, acting out in front. So it definitely stood the test of time. So anything that stands the test of time, I think, does have to have some artistic value. Yeah.
So out of all the things that you do, you know, from dancing, and I know that you're dancing in Africa, in South Africa, and you mentioned Jamaica, where you recorded, got an inspiration for Voodoo Princess, and you're singing, and circus. What appeals to you the most?
I think it depends on the mood I'm in. I think that's why I need to do so many different styles, because I'm so moody. Dancing can be really fun, and for me, dancing is more relaxing than singing. But classical singing can be so fulfilling, but the classical singing takes a certain amount of preparation and concentration and sometimes stress. I have to worry about my vocal cords, and I have to worry about my whole respiratory system. And if I have an important classical concert coming up, I have to be so careful. If I hear somebody has a cold, I run away from them. Whereas dancing is just sort of relaxing and fun. So it's hard to say. I think it's kind of like what Ado Annie said in Oklahoma when she was asked which guy she likes better because she was dating so many different guys. She says, whichever one I'm with.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, and we're so glad that you came on.
Me too.
And, you know, we want to wish you continued success as you make all your journeys all around the world. What's your next country you're going to visit?
You know, I think the next trip I want to do is a medical mission. There's a group called Mending Kids International that a friend of mine named Nikki Noxon told me about. And it's not a mission as in any kind of religious mission. It's only to help out medically. And you go to maybe a place like China or somewhere, and you pay for your trip, and then you volunteer at the hospital for maybe a week or so. And then also you're exposed to the culture and meet people. So I have to figure out where with Mending Kids International I want to go. And I think that might be one of my next new countries.
China?
I'd love to go. Maybe China, or they also do a lot in Ethiopia, so maybe Ethiopia. Now, as far as returning, I'd love to return to Switzerland soon, or Vienna. That'll be soon.
Oh, Vienna.
Yeah, love Vienna. have you been?
You have quite the storybook life, and, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of envious listeners out there besides myself. So... So we look forward to your next snake dance, and maybe you could throw it up on YouTube.
Okay, yeah, that's right. That's right. We got to get better lighting next time, because when I did that snake dance, it was pretty dark. So next one, yeah.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Christina Linhart, and thank you so much. And I encourage everyone to go out and pick up copies of her CDs,
thanks,
which are available on iTunes, CD Baby, and, you know, pretty much everywhere fine music is sold. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
To learn more about Christina Linhart, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com. Sipping on rosé, silver lake, sun coming up all lazy. Slow cooking pancakes for my boy, still up, still fresh as a daisy. Playing ping pong all night long, everything's all neon and hazy. Chanel this, Chanel that, hell yeah, all my girls vintage Chanel, baby.
Never Let Me Go, from the Booker Prize-winning author of The Remains of the Day and When We Were Orphans, comes an unforgettable edge-of-your-seat mystery that is at once heartbreakingly tender and morally courageous about what it means to be human. Hallisham seems like a pleasant English boarding school, far from the influences of the city. Its students are well-tended and supported, trained in art and literature, and become just the sort of people the world wants them to be. But curiously, they are taught nothing of the outside world and are allowed little contact with it. Within the grounds of Hallisham, Kathy grows from schoolgirl to young woman, but it's only when she and her friends Ruth and Tommy leave the safe grounds of the school, as they always knew they would, that they realize the full truth of what Hallisham is. Never Let Me Go breaks through the boundaries of the literary novel. It is a gripping mystery, a beautiful love story, and also a scathing critique of human arrogance and a moral examination of how we treat the vulnerable and different in our society. In exploring the themes of memory and the impact of the past, Ishiguro takes on the idea of a possible future to create his most moving and powerful book to date.
We'd all seen plenty of Tommy's tantrums by then, so we came down off our stools and spread ourselves around the room. We tried to start up a conversation about something else, but there was Tommy going on and on in the background, and although at first we just rolled our eyes and tried to ignore it, in the end, probably a full 10 minutes after we'd first moved away, we were back up at the windows again. The other boys were now completely out of view, and Tommy was no longer trying to direct his comments in any particular direction. He was just raving, flinging his limbs about, at the sky, at the wind, at the nearest fence post. Laura said he was maybe rehearsing his Shakespeare. Someone else pointed out how each time he screamed something he'd raise one foot off the ground, pointing it outwards, like a dog doing a pee. Actually, I'd noticed the same foot movement myself. But what had struck me was that each time he stamped the foot back down again, flecks of mud flew up around his shins. I thought again about his precious shirt, but he was too far away for me to see if he'd got much mud on it. I suppose it is a bit cruel, Ruth said, the way they always work him up like that. But it's his own fault. If he learned to keep his cool, they'd leave him alone. They'd still keep on at him, Hannah said. Graham Kay's temper's just as bad, but that only makes them all the more careful with him. The reason they go for Tommy's because he's a layabout. Then everyone was talking at once, about how Tommy never even tried to be creative, about how he hadn't even put anything in for the spring exchange. I suppose the truth was, by that stage, each of us was secretly wishing a guardian would come from the house and take him away. And although we hadn't had any part in this latest plan to rile Tommy, we had taken out ringside seats, and we were starting to feel guilty. But there was no sign of a guardian, so we just kept swapping reasons why Tommy deserved everything he got. Then, when Ruth looked at her watch and said even though we still had time, we should get back to the main house, nobody argued. Tommy was still going strong as we came out of the pavilion. The house was over to our left, and since Tommy was standing in the field straight ahead of us, there was no need to go anywhere near him.
Ishiguro carefully and deliberately unfolds Halisham's secrets one by one, piece by piece, says the Washington Post. Kazuo Ishiguro is the author of several novels, including the international bestsellers The Remains of the Day, which won the Booker Prize, An Artist of the Floating World, which won the Whitbread Award, and Never Let Me Go. He received an OBE for service to literature and the Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts de la Lettre. He lives in London with his wife and daughter. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now, stay there.
Time to give in to the kindness of strangers.